Yes.
It's my pleasure to introduce John Horrigan, and I know one thing for sure. He does not remember the hurricane of 1938. He can smile all he wants, but we know, I think probably some of us can. I know. I remember it. John, if you can read this up here, he's a New England folklorist, weather historian, historical astronomer, great fire historian, economic historian, professional sports announcer. Yeah, where?
With the New England Patriots alumni and the Boston Bruins alumni.
Oh, very good. See? Ask and you find out. Summit in Green Harbor. He has CDs on sale, and he's going to talk about the hurricane of 1938, and we hope to have John back for our next season, and he's going to do a program on apparitions through the years of the Blessed Virgin. Is that right? Did I get it right? So that sounds interesting. So now John's going to, have you finished your copy? You're all set? Okay.
Thank you, Jerry. Well, as I look out over the crowd here, I'm a bit disappointed because I was hoping that somebody in the crowd was here during 1938, but you're way too young for me. How ironic is it today that we have this meeting postponed from 2 days ago for a blizzard that never came, and I'm going to be talking about a hurricane that was never predicted. One of my axioms is there's always someone in the room who knows more about the subject than I do and someone who thinks that they know more about the subject than I do. All of you probably know more about this subject than I do. Today we're going to be talking about the snapshot, about what is a hurricane, look at some factoids of the great hurricane of 1938, a history of North Atlantic hurricanes, the two other great hurricanes of New England, that being the Great Colonial Hurricane and the Great September Gale, the track of GH-38, the summer of 38, a muffed forecast, record low air pressure, and then as the hurricane struck New York City, Long Island, Connecticut, the Great New London Fire, Rhode Island, something I call wedding splashers, the Mary Poppins of Brent Rock, and then the Great Flood of 36, the battering of the Connecticut River Valley, the mass impact, and the death of a monster. As we look at our talk here today, we're going to see acts of bravery and acts of cowardice, acts of kindness and selfishness. There was providence, luck, and cruel fate. Up until that time, this was the most costly disaster in U.S. history. It's something I call a lateral buzzsaw. And please, don't worry if you can't read the graphics. I'll drive the narrative. Trust me, they'll be able to hear me all the way down into Stoughton. So nobody was prepared because nobody was warned. There were unlikely heroes, and by the time this thing died out on September 28, 1938, 10 states and 2 countries were affected. Now, I'm not going to hit you with a lot of math, but Category 1 through 5, you hear about these storms, starting from a tropical depression. That's when you have winds gusting from 23 to 39 miles per hour, a tropical storm 40 to 73 miles per hour, and then a Category 1 is 74 to 95 miles per hour, all the way up to a Category 5, which is greater than 155 miles per hour. We're talking about a 3-plus here today. Now, the last one that we can recall of being any hurricane strength, it was Hurricane Bob, which decimated the Cape Cod Canal Wareham area. Now, in terms of the hurricane of 38, this was nothing more than a hiccup. It was a tropical depression, maybe a tropical storm when it hit landfall. But if you look at hurricane damage, you have 3 factors. One is storm surge. And storm surge is a dome of water 40 to 60 miles long that moves onto the shoreline near the landfall point of the eye. A cubic yard of seawater weighs approximately 1,700 pounds. As this water is constantly slamming into shoreline structures, even well-built structures quickly get demolished. As the waters move inland, more debris floats along with it, causing further damage. Storm surge is responsible for nearly 90% of all hurricane-related deaths and injuries. As an example, in 1876, in Bakergunj, India, 200,000 died due to storm surge. In Haiphong, China, 1881, 300,000 people died. Of course, you're talking about wind damage. The force of the wind can quickly decimate a tree population, down power lines and utility poles, knock over signs, and may be strong enough to destroy some homes and buildings. Flying debris can also cause damage, and in cases where people are caught outdoors, injuries and death. When hurricanes first make landfall, it's common for tornadoes to form, which can cause severe localized wind damage. In most cases, however, wind is a secondary cause of damage. Storm surge is the primary cause. And then finally, rainfall and flooding. Torrential rains that normally accompany a hurricane can cause serious flooding. Whereas the storm surge and high winds are concentrated near the eye, the rain may extend for hundreds of miles. It may last for several days, affecting areas well after the hurricane has diminished. As you look at the coastline of the United States, we are very vulnerable to the Atlantic Ocean, from Portland, Maine, all the way down to Miami, Florida, and with the highest concentrations of population running from Washington, D.C., through Philadelphia, New York City, and Boston. Here's an interesting map. It shows a track of all hurricanes over the past 100 years, 1886 to 1996. And as you can see, they are formed off the west coast of Africa. They track in a north-northwest direction, and then they either cut over into the Gulf of Mexico, as Hurricane Katrina did, or they track to the northeast. Now, if you look at the intense New England hurricane strikes of antiquity, and this is kind of neat, an analysis of sedimentary deposits by geologists reveal major hurricane strikes. These are major hurricane strikes that have hit along the New England coast from 1100 to 1150 during the Crusades, 1300 to 1400, 1400 to 1450, and I want to say that Columbus picked a great time to come across the Atlantic because there were no hurricanes. And then there are three major hurricanes that precede GH-38. They are 1635, the Great Colonial Hurricane, the Great September Gale of 1815, and something that I classify as a major hurricane called Saxby's Gale, 1869. Just looking at the Great Colonial Hurricane, it took place on August 16, 1635. Governor John Winthrop, quote, "It blew with such violence, with abundance of rain, that it blew down many hundreds of trees, overthrew some houses, and drove ships from their anchors. The tide rose at Narragansett 14 feet higher than ordinary and drowned 8 Indians flying from their wigwams." The Angel Gabriel, a ship, was lost at sea off the Massachusetts coastline, and 21 people lost their lives. The eye passed to the south and east of Boston, and William Bradford in Plymouth said, quote, "It caused the sea to swell to the south wind of this place above 20 foot right up and down and made many of the Indians to climb into trees for their safety." Storm surge. "It continued above 5 or 6 hours, but the violence began to abate. It blew down many hundreds of thousands of trees. The signs and marks of it will remain this 100 years in these parts." And of course, they attribute it to some sort of astronomical event when he says the moon suffered a great eclipse the second night after it. The Great September Gale of 1815 took place on Saturday, September 23rd, 1815. Historian Noah Webster, quote, "The storm was a proper hurricane. It was one of several severe storms that struck the North Atlantic shipping lanes that season. It struck Long Island near Center Mariches, similar to the hurricane of 38, and Montauk Point Lighthouse suffered heavy damage. In the East River in New York, wharves were underwater by 3 feet at 10 o'clock in the morning. And the eye passed to the east of Hartford and Springfield, Mass." The Hampshire Gazette said, quote, "It was a tornado of wind and rain. Yale recorded 6.5 inches of rain over 2 days. The New Haven Register said, quote, "It drifted several hogshead of rum and molasses from the wharf," which is very important in those days. Eastern Connecticut, all of Rhode Island, and east central Massachusetts was raked. The rain had a salty flavor to it, and houses and trees had a white hue from ocean froth. Now, it whipped 90-foot sprays from the Charles River. There is an uncorroborated report of a water spout. That is a tornado on water on the Charles River during the Great September Gale. So if you look at the major 20th century New England hurricanes, you have GH-38. The track is in blue. The Great Atlantic Hurricane, again, hurricanes weren't named until the 1950s. That took place in 1944 in yellow. And then we have Hurricane Carol, 1954 in red. Just looking at the track of GH-38, again, it formed off the west coast of Africa, tracked generally to the west, moved to the west-northwest, then to the north-northwest, and then it headed due north. It was an extratropical cyclone. That means that as the eye wall diminishes, the duration is prolonged. So as this hurricane was collapsed, it stalled over New England, dumped a lot of rain. The track was unbelievable. September 18th, 8:30 in the morning, it stood well to the northeast of Cuba. By the next day, it had only tracked just a little due east of the Bahamas. The following day, on the 20th, at 8:30 in the morning, now check the speed on this, it's to the northeast of the Bahamas. The next day, it's off Cape Hatteras. And that afternoon, it strikes New England. This thing was moving up the coast. Here's the path. So if you look at just the category strength of it, it began as a tropical storm on September 10th. It went to a Category 1 on the 13th of September, Cat 2 on 9/16. On the 17th of September, a Cat 3, Category 4 later that day with sustaining winds of 132 miles per hour. 2 days later, it hit a Category 5 as it was due east of the Bahamas with 160 mile per hour winds. It downgraded to a Category 4 on the 20th of September, and when it struck landfall, it hit as a 3+. It was the most costly disaster in United States history up to that year. It moved rapidly up the coast at 67 miles per hour. It moved 700 miles in 12 hours. Landfall winds at 127 miles per hour, sustained at 121 miles per hour. Top winds at 156 miles per hour, although the Blue Hills, just down the road from here in Canton, is 186 miles per hour. There is 40-foot storm surge in places. It hit at high tide, and seas rose 17 feet in some places. Check this out. Salt water sprayed houses in Montpelier, Vermont, 120 miles away from the ocean. Southern New England coastal areas were inundated. Most victims drowned. Some had their clothes blown right off. The first impact of the storm surge registered on seismographs in Alaska. And seawater destroyed vegetation 20 miles inland. And there were just so many stories from so many towns in Long Island, Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and even Vermont. Let's look at that summer of 38. Record precipitation in June and July. Very wet. A muggy August, a really muggy September, and then the rains came. September 12th and September 15th recorded an inch of rain each day. The rivers were rising. Then from September 17th through the 20th, there was constant rainfall. On September 20th, even before the hurricane, was the heaviest rainfall. 13 inches of rain fell in 5 days in the Thames River Basin in Connecticut. Some areas reported 17 inches of rain in 5 days. So what do you have? You have soft soil, weakened foundations, and the roots of trees are just ready to topple. So the hurricane's impact was exacerbated. Let's look at the newspaper. Wednesday, September 21st, 1938. The Treaty of Munich is imminent. Chamberlain, that noodle over in Britain that preceded Churchill, hands over the Sudetenland in Czechoslovakia to Hitler through annexation. Of course, Churchill's very upset with it. Our beloved Red Sox beat the St. Louis Browns 8-4, but remained 11 games back in the American League. The weather forecast, according to the Lowell Sun, quote, "The weatherman says more rain and cooler tonight and Thursday." Dripping with irony, the day of the hurricane, the New York Times posted this editorial. Here's an excerpt. "Every year, an average of 3 such whirlwinds sweep the tropical North Atlantic between June and November. In 1933, there was an all-time record of 20. If New York and the rest of the world have been so well informed about the cyclone, it is because of an admirably organized meteorological service." So many errors. Now remember, they had no tools. And again, my opening remarks here for the Canton Catholic Women's Club was that we are here 2 days later because of a blizzard that didn't come. Now, I can look at the radar map and I can mow my lawn up until 5 minutes before the rain falls. I could tell when the front comes. So I think the meteorologists, that they're actors, by the way. They get their script off of the National Weather Service. But it's almost like witchcraft. So we have to cut them some slack when they make mistakes. And I often shriek when the National Hurricane Service predicts 8 hurricanes and we get none for the season because then people get lax. But in Washington, at the Weather Bureau, a 28-year-old rookie meteorologist, Charlie Pierce, is filling in for 2 vacationing meteorologists, and he argues that the storm would be sandwiched between 2 high-pressure systems and head directly north through New England. A longtime veteran, Charles Mitchell, ignores his forecast. "No hurricane has hit New Jersey during my tenure, and this current storm is weakening." And then the barometer starts to take a nosedive. On board the RMS Carinthia, they have a reading of 27.85, the lowest in recorded history in the North Atlantic, off the coast of Virginia, early in the morning of September 21st, 1938. In Fire Island, within 2 hours, it went from a low reading of 29.78 to an inconceivable low of 27.43 on the morning of the 21st of September. And my favorite story, on September 21st, a man from West Hampton Beach thought his new barometer was broken when it measured 28. While at the post office sending it back, his house was blown away. The father of typhoons. On the Red Star liner Konigstein, skipper Alfred Leidig has barometer readings of 28.40 with 100-mile-per-hour winds. On September 19th, Reverend Ernest Gierzi, an Italian Jesuit with 23 years of meteorological experience, while on the Italian liner Conte di Savoia, bound for New York, states, quote, "One of my children will be around in about 3 days." This is after he checked his weather charts, barometric readings, and sky conditions. And here it goes. It hits New York City. An average gale of 65 miles per hour. It's a tropical storm, and 4.5 inches of rain falls. The city's at a standstill from 3 o'clock till 6 o'clock in the evening on the afternoon of the 21st. Thousands were marooned in office buildings. There was extensive flooding of streets and basements. At 8:45, a power failure at Consolidated Edison left all of the Bronx and parts of Manhattan in darkness. The only death was a hitchhiker who abandoned the stalled car of the gentleman who gave him a ride. He stepped out the door and he was carried away by the current, never seen again. At Fort Schuyler Road in Throgs Neck, they had 9-foot waters at 7:30 that night. J. Gilbert Finning, and these are the storm's first heroes, and William McGrath, age 30. During the evacuation of Fort Schuyler Road, Finning slips while pushing an elderly woman in a boat. McGrath goes after him. Both perish. McGrath is posthumously awarded the Carnegie Hero Fund Commission's Bronze Medal. It's been nicknamed the Long Island Express, and the image up on the screen shows the exposure of Long Island in New York to the fierce Atlantic. Long Island suffered tremendous devastation, especially along the Long Island Expressway. And here's the selfishness motive. Some wealthy homeowners forced their servants to remain in their mansions and cottages while they evacuated, sealing their fate. One account had a family and friends packed into a car that drove off with their servants, watching in ankle-deep rising water on their driveway. Some pets and horses were left behind to fend for themselves and subsequently drowned in the storm surge. After a tree fell on his car, a man on Long Island frantically shook a police officer, saying, "That car's brand new. Who can I sue? Who can I sue?" And of course, there was substantial looting. East Hampton, blocked off. A devastated village here in southern Long Island. West Hampton, Long Island. 28 dead, 4 missing, 153 of 179 houses destroyed. Trees fell like tenpins along the highway as the Long Island Expressway was blocked off. Bridgehampton, New York, suffered severe damage. Of the estimated 2 billion trees that were lost, I know billion means nothing nowadays in this economy. Here's a trillion for you, a billion for you. Of the estimated 2 billion trees that were lost in the Northeast during this hurricane, 3,500 trees were lost in the Bridgehampton, Sagaponack, Hayground area alone. The elms and locusts that formed a half-mile-long arch over Main Street had been planted before the American Revolution and can still be seen in the canvases of many important artists of that day. When the storm was over, 42% of the Main Street elms were gone. Nassau, Long Island, destroyed. Dune Deck, Bayside, New York. The ocean-torn inlet between West Hampton Beach and Quogue, 400 feet wide and 20 feet deep. Waves broke on lawns 1 mile inland. Far Island, Long Island. 6 miles south of Bayshore across Great South Bay. Salt Air lost 125 houses. Kismet and Fair Harbor, 91 houses. Oak Beach, 29 houses, and Ocean Beach and Point of Woods suffered severe damage. Over 200 homes had been perched on dunes 20 feet high on Fire Island. The next day, it was nothing but a sand dune. Frederick Foster Durham, he's 54 years old, the vice president of the Fulton Trust Company. His New York train is marooned in Warwick, Rhode Island. His 15-minute trip took 2 hours that day. He got home by 8 p.m., and as he washed up while his wife was making dinner, he dropped dead from exhaustion and exposure. At Salt Air, the morning after the storm, a young blonde girl sat in a box. As Chief Assistant D.A. Lindsay Henry arrived, she asked, "Could you assist us in the search for a body?" "Of course," he said. "Whose body is it?" She shut her eyes tightly and sadly said, "My mother's." Heroes, West Hampton Police Chief Stanley Teller and Officer Timothy Robinson saved 17 people. They're halfway across the West Bay Bridge, and they abandoned their two cruisers and waded and swam the rest of the way. They saved a helpless woman and her three children in deep water on Dune Road. They led all 17 people on that road onto the roof of a house. A huge wave swept the house off of its foundation. 3 hours later, they landed at Quogue, having crossed the bay. No lives were lost. Now, here's a flight of the Burghards. George and Mabel Burghard, their fox terrier dog, Bitsy, and their cocker spaniel, Peter, with their caretakers, Carl and Selma Dalen, I said Dalen, not Palin, rented a cottage 75 feet from the top of a 9-foot dune, 100 feet from Dune Road, and 75 feet from the Coast Guard station. The distance to the water's edge was 200 feet. So they're right on the water, but there's a dune that's blocking their view to the ocean. Their neighbors had a 30-foot cabin cruiser moored to the dock between the houses. 10 a.m., the wind is strong from the north, it's overcast, there's drizzle, and the seas are heavy. An hour later, 11 a.m., the winds shift to the east, then to the northeast at gale force. Dalen reports water bubbling through concrete floor of his garage. They thought that it was fresh water from the bay, but they tasted it. It was salt water. Mabel puts on her swimsuit. Noontime, the neighbor's boat is drifting. Burghard calls Chief Botswain's mate, James Ketchum, at Mauritius Coast Guard Station, 3 miles to the west of their location. Ketchum says, "I'll be right down." 1 p.m., radio station WESF. "We interrupt this broadcast to tell you that the West Indies hurricane is in the mid-Atlantic." No, it's not. It's right on top of them. Electric power at this point is still on. At 1:30 p.m., their friend Bill Ottman calls and says his garage is just blown into the bay. 2 o'clock. 90-mile-per-hour winds are shifting to the east. The water is now 2 feet deep in the garage. Mabel is sewing in the sunroom with her back to the bay windows. Mrs. Dalen tells her to change her seat. Just as she does, the window blows out everywhere with glass shards scattering. 2:30 p.m., wind and rain intensifies. Their bathhouse is swept away. 3 o'clock, Burghard tells Dalen to pack clothes and move to the third floor. 3:10 p.m., a wave breaks through the back door and sweeps Dalen off of his feet. 3:30 p.m., John Avery, Coast Guard, comes across the meadow. "Let's get moving quick, people. No time to lose. Let's get out of here." The high tide is due at 6:10 p.m. Burghard stuffs his tennis tickets for the match at Forest Hills the following day into his pocket. 4 o'clock, Mabel Burghard picks up Peter and George picks up Bitsy. They're picking up their dogs. I own 3 cats, so that's what I would do the first thing, grab my pets. The Dalens, who are much older, are dilly-dallying. The wind is now up over 100 miles per hour. It's a half-mile walk to the bridge across the bay. Mrs. Dalen is being nearly dragged by Avery. Old Carl Dalen clings to the fence post back on the driveway as the group moves down the road. Now, just imagine walking into 120-mile-per-hour winds. It's exhausting. Carl then sits down on the fence, exhausted, his head down. He's now 75 feet behind the group. Imagine if you're Mrs. Dalen, your partner for life now, is sitting, a death warrant, because he's exhausted. He can't hear their call due to the wind. Mrs. Dalen is now hysterical for her husband. The wind suddenly shifts from the southeast at 110 miles per hour. Suddenly, 50-foot breakers roar over the sand dunes. Flotsam drifts by in the raging sea torrents. There's a boat tied to the dock, and the group moves towards it. 4:15 p.m., with a sickening crash, the Coast Guard station hits the bay and smashes to pieces. Just then, the line snaps, and the boat, their only salvation, is dragged out to sea. Electric wires hit the ocean in puddles. Electrocution is a distinct possibility. Mrs. Dalen is now trailing the group. She's 50 feet behind, refusing to move, calling to her husband, who's 125 feet behind. The Burghards, with dogs under their arms, go out onto a broken dock and lie down, hoping to ride it like a surfboard. Just then, a large, flat piece of wooden siding comes by, and Mabel, George, the dogs, and Coast Guardsman Avery climb onto it. The wind had driven the bay water across to the mainland with such force that for about 200 feet, the bay bottom was dry. The Dalens are now helpless. The Burghards and Avery jump off the board and wait for the giant wave that takes them 200 feet out into the bay. 6-foot waves continually wash them off the board and they climb right back on. They dodge flotsam, cars, jagged glass, and boards with nails moving quickly by them. The dogs are placed on a trailer little raft behind them. Pitsy is washed off, but Peter grabs him by the ear and drags him back onto the raft. They paddle around huge chunks of houses and debris. Ducks fly by backwards at 40 miles per hour. A raft is grounded in berry bushes. Just want to make a comment here. A man who was raising chickens had just banded his chickens, a chicken farm on Long Island. One of his banded chickens was found in Connecticut on the shoreline. Bitsy disappears in the brush. They land 1 mile west from their house at Onek across the bay and head to higher ground at the golf course. They wave down a car and make their way into West Hampton. Avery, meanwhile, he's done. He moves off to help more people. Some of their personal belongings are found miles away from their house. When the Daylands' bodies are located, Carl is found near the golf course, ironically where they landed, and he had broken his leg. John Avery, of course, was cited for his bravery. Wood is pierced through wood like an arrow. Every street corner has an armed man looking for looters. There is 48 hours of price gouging. There's that selfish motive again. And that awful sea smell stuck around for over a year. Quogue, New York, before and after, the gymnasium is now a morgue. The breach at Shinnecock Inlet. Before, after. A peninsula like this, the waves just broke through and created a new channel. And it changed the currents in the harbor. And if you look at Massachusetts, we've got Gurnet, where I grew up, Somers, Saquish Neck, Duxbury Beach. You get down to the Chatham area, even parts of Provincetown that are vulnerable to breaches. And then the heroes of Stony Point. Unlikely heroes, huh? 60 colonies of beavers from the Adirondacks. 500 beavers can constitute 60 colonies. They built 60 dams that night. They knew what was going on. The dams in Palisades Park held back swollen rivers and ponds. They worked all through the night of the hurricane to fortify their bulwarks. Long Mountain Beaver Pond doubled in size from 5 to 10 acres due to the dam made of mud, sticks, stones, and sod. It was 150 yards long and 6 feet high, and it held fast, only spilling 18 inches of water over its crest. Cedar Hill Pond Dam doubled in size to 8 acres. It was 40 feet wide, and water rose 2 feet. These little bucktooth heroes saved 5 arterial highways that were used for the evacuation. They were Long Mountain Road, Johnstown Road, U.S. Highway 6, 17, and 9 West. The plight of the Park City. A ferry left Port Jefferson at 2 p.m. for a 2-hour run to Bridgeport, Connecticut. Captain Ray Dickerson tried to turn back. The wind shift forced him to drop his anchor. Rogue waves filled the hold with over 5 feet of water. And at 3:15, fires under the boilers went out, stopping the steam engine. They were adrift. The anchor finally caught at 7:30 p.m. as the crew bailed out the engine room. Most passengers sat in cars for the entire night on the ferry. A ship spotted the ferry at 7 a.m. and towed them to safety. It was a 21-hour odyssey, and the Ruth R. was blown from Montauk to Block Island for 18 hours. And now Connecticut, the southeast coast, is slammed from Saybrook to Stonington. Great train here. This is the Bostonian. The train that derailed outside of Stonington, Connecticut, the Bostonian, had 275 passengers, returning many students to prep schools. Well, at 3:30, the railroads were ordered to halt, and train firemen checked the tracks, and water was rising rapidly, and they wanted to evacuate the train. Suddenly, a 30-foot sailboat smashed into the train. So, the conductor, a man by the name of Brown, tried to yell to the students who were fidgeting about to get to the front of the train, and they were all just loud and having a good old time. He smashes the fire axe in the train, raises it over his head. Now you want to play ball? They all move to the front of the train. Some other passengers, first class, had just been served dinner. And, I just got served my dinner. Brown raised the axe. You want dinner? You're going to have it up front. They all move to the front. So suddenly, the engineer got the engine moving on the fourth try, plowing debris and dragging wires out of his way. One of his men dove into the water and managed to uncouple the derailed cars. He saved many lives when they finally rolled into Stonington Station, the Bostonian. famous picture, an iconic picture of the hurricane of 1938, is the toppling of this 120-year-old steeple in Danielson, Connecticut. And then Katharine Hepburn. We're in Old Saybrook, Connecticut. Kate is considered to be box office poison. She had just auditioned for a film that was about to commence production. With her boyfriend, Red Hammond, she went and played a round of golf that day. It was very humid and breezy. Well, on the par 3 ninth hole, she scored a hole-in-one. She finished with her best round ever, an incredible 31 on 9 holes. Afterwards, she and Red went for a swim in front of their house. She stated about the breezy weather and the rising surf, "Something very special is going to happen." Now, the Hepburn family had an elegant summer house there since the turn of the century. Her brother, Dick, was working on a script. Kate was waiting to hear if she got the part of Scarlett O'Hara in, ironically, Gone with the Wind. She had just finished making up a bust, making a movie called Bringing Up Baby earlier in the year. Well, the water rose 17 feet high, and Dick and Katharine got the family out as two chimneys crumbled and the guest cottage drifted a half mile away. Family heirlooms were lost in mud, and 4 days later, when Kate got home, thank you very much, she went on her knees, some say inebriated, digging for her family jewels and heirlooms as Red tugged gently on her shoulder and whispered, "Honey, it's time to leave." Meanwhile, her brother, Dick, found his typewriter and his scripts perfectly intact. Of course, they never got published. Now we go to the Battle of Colts Dyke, the Connecticut River in Hartford. 1,200 WPA workers, World War I veterans, college students, and volunteers fight to keep 1 million tons of water out of the south end of the city that was devastated in 1936. I'm going to go to that in a second. This region had suffered a devastating flood in 1936, so it's still fresh in their memories. Well, the Army engineers say there's a 50-50 chance that the bulwark will hold when the water crests at an incredible 28 feet. There was a plan to dynamite Clark's Dyke should it not hold to save the industrial area. There's debate here. Again, we're late in the Depression. Okay, we're coming out of it. Do you save residential areas or do you save the industrial area and jobs? They chose to save the industrial area and jobs. The Connecticut River at Hartford, you can see the floodplain. An arrow punched to the Traveler's Insurance Tower. The clock on the old State House stopped at 4:10 p.m. Mrs. Carl Carlson, driving towards Guilford, was stopped in traffic as they removed a tree from the road. She picked up a book to read. Just then, a tree came crashing down on her car and killed her instantly. She was reading Gone with the Wind. The river rose 4 inches per hour. Matt Strong caught a 5-pound bass with his bare hands on Main Street. Frank Fredsall's apple tree was blown over and then later blown upright and yielded fruit for a few years after. In New London, there was storm surge, 110-mile-per-hour winds, and a great fire. The steamship Tulip was stuffed along the railroad tracks in New London. Countless marine craft were destroyed as they were east of the eye. $4 million worth of damage, that was the preliminary estimate of 1938 dollars. Bad New London fires. Well, Benedict Arnold burned it to the ground during the American Revolution in 1781, and the glow of the 1938 fire could be seen in the cloudy skies from the Long Island and Rhode Island coastlines. The great hurricane of 1938 fire burned dozens of buildings before it burned itself out in the dampness. It caused extensive damage to New London, and you're going to see somebody seeing that glow in just a moment. It was reported at 4:30 p.m. All communication went down by 4:50, and because the embers were blown into Star Green and Pearl Street warehouses, the entire Low Harbor was ablaze. The fire was left to feed on itself as whipping winds shifted, and the spray of the firefighters, it was coming back in their face, and they couldn't get good positions to put it out. But 13 commercial buildings burned to the ground, 89 buildings were damaged or destroyed. In Cheshire, Patrick Joyce was killed when he was hurled against a brick wall of a prison building. And now it hits Rhode Island, the vulnerable Rhode Island coastline. Again, there's still no word. The plight of the Moore family washed out at Watch Hill. 11 people, including 3 servants, crammed into the attic of a sturdy house on the edge of Little Narragansett Bay. Mr. Moore had suffered a heart attack that morning, but somehow managed to board up his house. The roof was ripped off and thrown into the sea, and the entire family jumps onto an ad hoc raft. Huge waves crashed on them, and hammerhead sharks followed the raft. They were probably brought up by the hurricane and the current that just sucked all the fish north. They floated clear across the peninsula, through the bay, and drifted onto a cove on Barn Island. There they huddled in an abandoned barn, and they watched the glow of the new London fire. All 39 houses on Watch Hill were wiped off the face of the earth. A 20-mile stretch from Napatree Point to Point Judith, 175 people were dead. Napatree Point before and after, built right up on the water. Next day, if you were to sail by there, you'd have trouble convincing people that homes once stood in that neck. The storm hit westerly Rhode Island at 3:50 p.m. 100 people were killed. At Misquamicut Beach in Rhode Island, 194 of 200 homes were destroyed. 50 bodies were found washed up in the sand dunes. I often laugh when I see those thrill-seeking surfers that go out and high chop. And they are crazy. They are crazy. Can you say uninsured? Look at the devastation here. It's just one big wood pile at Misquamicut Beach along the Rhode Island coast. Island Park, Rhode Island, 19 dead, 198 of 200 houses destroyed. The tidal marsh and the storm surge at Newport, Rhode Island, caused substantial damage. Conemaugh Beach, Narragansett Bay, another 100 homes were destroyed. At Oakland Beach, 100 left homeless. A woman says, "My baby has just been blown out of my arms." Jamestown, Rhode Island, 14 people perished in Barrington. 86 of 100 boats were destroyed on Block Island. And the Governor Carr Ferry ran ashore on Jamestown, Rhode Island. The three quotes that you heard most out of people, "Where do I go now? Everything that I own is gone." And of course, sadly, I had no insurance. The rats at Brown University. This is not a reference to the people who work in the bursar's office. Well, you've heard about how animals react prior to storms and earthquakes. Well, the calls began to come into a couple of local exterminators that mice had infested a woman's dormitory and that rats were seen at the library. Were they seeking higher ground at College Hill? Many cats and dogs went missing on the morning of the hurricane. Squirrels and birds were reportedly moving about in an agitated manner, according to residents of Plymouth. Providence, the Providence flood. The city is a perfect funnel and aqueduct. Storm surge struck at 5:15 just as the power went out and people were leaving their offices. A white wall of water rushed up Providence River and a deluge of water 13 feet high in some places on city streets. Providence City Hall and the Biltmore Hotel. The Providence River rose 17 feet in 70 minutes. Appliances and consumer goods floated down the streets from department stores. A canoe was washed up at Exchange Place and sat there for over a week in downtown Providence. The Monhegan, a steamer, sunken, was wedged in between a pier in downtown Providence. Something I call Wedding Splashers, a play in that awful movie called Wedding Crashers. Joe Fogel and Lorraine Martin were scheduled to get married that day, and they were highlighted on the social pages back then. You have this ghastly thing called the Inside Track in the Boston Herald where the Gossip Girls, well, there was the society page, a lot more gentle and... Well, they're supposed to get married on the second floor in the ballroom of the Narragansett Hotel in downtown Providence. Where's Joe? Cold feet? No, he's stuck at Union Street Station with his family. So 500 refugees sought shelter from the storm in the hotel. And what do? They feasted on the wedding banquet and drank all the champagne. Joe shows up at 11 o'clock. They're married by candlelight by an anxious minister. Then they take a short walk on smelly, muddy streets. The water had receded in Providence by 10 p.m. to their honeymoon suite at the Biltmore. The Mary Poppins of Brant Rock. A 10-year-old boy in Brant Rock, Massachusetts, that's a part of Marshfield, saw that the weather was getting wild late on the afternoon of September 21st, 1938. He decided to heighten the exhilaration of the storm by getting his grandfather's best umbrella out of the closet and climbing up onto the garage roof. He jumped off the roof, thinking that he might fly. As he tumbled to the ground, the umbrella was bent and broken. He received, quote, red bottom for his poor judgment. That boy was my father. The Great Flood of 36, the precursor to the great hurricane. And again, all those trees that were thrown down caused, they laid there for years. They were used as timber for houses and for the war effort. But they also served as kindling wood for a conflagration that would hit Brent Rock, Marshfield in 1941 that would burn 500 structures to the ground. In fact, that day on April 21st, 1941, there were over 200 fires throughout Massachusetts. But anyways, in regards to the Great Flood, no such widespread waves of destruction have swept over New England in the memory of living men, according to the Boston Globe. The flood devastated five states in March of 1936. They followed days of heavy rains and quickly burst the banks of the Merrimack, Connecticut, and Kennebec rivers. As many as 100,000 people were displaced and some 100 died. And as you can just see in Northampton, the Connecticut River flooding. Police in Springfield used boats instead of cruisers. Here's a rarity. Here's an eyewitness to the storm surge of the hurricane of 1938 that hit Horseneck Beach at Buzzards Bay. This is 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Quote, a long black band approaching. A solid black wall of water looked like an unusually large black roller coming into the shore with its top being blown off so that it did not curl up and break like an ordinary wave. 30-footers hit Horseneck Beach. 41 perished in Fall River. Ships, boats, and barges were torn off their moorings and docks. The oil tanker Phoenix spills its cargo and is blown across the river onto lawns. In New Bedford, 9 cotton mills are destroyed. 10,000 employees are left jobless. The New Bedford economy would never recover from this storm. Just as the Portland Gale of 1898 destroyed Provincetown as a fishing port, New Bedford suffers. The Acushnet River rose 11 feet, and 1,500 people were left homeless in Fairhaven. And again, I don't know, didn't know there were 1,500 homes in Fairhaven at that time. Fishing fleets are overdue. The New Bedford Standard Times, quote, women stood with babies in their arms and watched the horizon in the ageless manner of wives whose men ply the sea. Others went from boat to boat asking questions. Everywhere, the answer was a simple negative shake of the head. Westport Harbor, see the devastation. New Bedford, heavy winds knocking down structures. This looks to be like a church. Woods Hole, battered. Wareham, destroyed. Bourne Bridge, a famous photograph here showing National Guardsmen standing on the roof in Cape Cod Canal, under the newborn bridge where a family had lost their lives, saluting them. Martha's Vineyard saw 25-foot waves at Chilmark, and the bridge from Gayhead to Menemsha was destroyed. There are all sorts of towns throughout Massachusetts that suffered damage. East Brookfield, Springfield, East Bridgewater, Mattapoisett, Taunton, Newton, Wareham, West Brookfield, Boston. Ware, Worcester, North Uxbridge in Putnam, Connecticut. It looks like a bombing raid. Downtown Boston, a tree fell on Arlington Street. At the Massachusetts State House, a tree fell across the street, blocking the egress of curious passerbys. The hat shell at the Esplanade on the Charles River in Boston flooded out. Even historic Lexington Green, where the battlefield of the American Revolution stood, had trees all across it. Exeter, New Hampshire suffered extensive damage. Peterborough, New Hampshire, with flooding downtown. And then you have the newspapers coming out. As you remember in those days, you'd have, what, three editions? And competing newspapers. Now we have something god-awful called blogging. 45 killed in wild hurricane. Property damage in millions. Hundreds hurt by wreckage. Underestimate. Then the Boston Evening Globe comes out. Hurricane dead, 250. Then Daily News says 322 dead. Now the Daily Record says deaths now 390. Boston Herald comes back out, says deaths mount to 515. It's estimated that about 700 people died. Facts of the hurricane. As I mentioned, peak steady winds 121 miles per hour with a peak gust of 186 miles per hour. Just down the road here, we can step outside and see Big Blue at the Blue Hill Observatory. The lowest pressure measured, and this is debatable, 27.94 in Bellport, New York. Peak storm surge, again debatable, 17 feet above normal high tide. I think it was higher. Peak wave heights, 50 feet at Gloucester. Death, 700, 600 in New England. Homeless, 63,000. 20,000 miles of power wire was knocked down. 8,900 homes and buildings were destroyed. 3,300 boats were lost. 26,000 automobiles were lost. 2 billion trees destroyed. The cost in 1938 dollars, $6.2 million. In 1998, adjusted, that was $15 billion. Call that $30 billion today. Shirley Ann Gatz was born at 3:28 p.m. in Eastern Long Island Hospital just as the roof blew off and flooded the delivery room. At this point, I ask, is anybody born on September 21st, 1938? I had a gentleman at one of my...
I was not, but my sister was not away.
There you go. Okay.
They named her Gail.
Ah, beautiful. They named her Gail. Wonderful story. There was a gentleman, he said he was a preemie 4 weeks early due to the hurricane. I do another story called The Great Northeast Blackout, which is a blackout that took place in November 1965. So I add 9 months and I ask who was born in 66. Some great hurricanes, as I mentioned, the Great Atlantic Hurricane 1944, which essentially took the same track as the Great Colonial Hurricane, the Great September Gale of 1815, and Great Hurricane of 1938. Edna just missed it, went up the Cape Cod Canal, 1954. Carol took the same track as the Great Hurricane, 1954. Diane, 1955, went inland over Carolinas and then in Virginia and then swept back out to sea, grazing the coast. Donna, 1960, essentially took the same track as the hurricane of 1938. So I will make a projection of the next major hurricane. The odds are that it will track the same way as GH-38. We know the most devastating hurricane ever to hit in terms of damage is Katrina that hit Louisiana and Mississippi. People forget the destruction that Mississippi endured during Katrina. They always talk about New Orleans. So what happens when the Cyclops comes? Well, scientific studies have shown that a gallon of milk and loaf of bread are not your best protection against a major storm. The cows go, oh no, before us. Check the tides and stay away from the beach. When they tell you to leave, leave. Do not panic in a traffic jam. Shut off your engine to conserve fuel. Know where the high ground is in your town and neighborhood. The winds will shift, so don't count on the wind blowing constantly in one direction. Most important thing of any survival is, if you can, carry clean drinking water. Always have water available. You can survive without food for several days. It's the water you need. Stay away from downed power lines and, if possible, water-containing downed lines. And be aware that trees and houses can topple in an instant. If you're swimming against the current, it's not advised. And if you're within 2 miles of the coastline, you're vulnerable to storm surge. And like I say, back to those risky surfers, if you're a clown, you'll certainly drown. Just the blast zone for a 21st century hurricane, if a hurricane were to hit nowadays, well, given the rivers, the Neponset, the Charles, the Mystic, this is where you're going to see some substantial flooding in the greater Boston area. My resources for today's talk, Michael Gramatico, A Wind to Shake the World. Actually, that's by Everett S. Allen. Great book. Pick it up. He was there. First day as a reporter, he shows up in New Bedford on September 21st, 1938. Sudden Sea, R.A. Scotty, Cherie Burns, The Great Hurricane of 1938. I love books on audio. If you can get this book on audio, it's marvelous. The woman who narrates it, great. And then The Hurricane of 38, Aram Gutsuzian. I also host a New England History Festival on November 13th in Watertown. We're going to have Ralph Waldo Emerson, John F. Kennedy, Edgar Allan Poe, 54th Massachusetts Volunteer Company. So that's my talk for today. Thank you very much for your patience. You've been a great audience. Now, here's where I get to ask. Again, I think you're all too young. None of you were around in 1938, but I'll guess maybe somebody was here. But please tell me anything that you can recollect during the hurricane of 38. Raise your hand, even if it's voluntary. Yes?
I was in high school at that time, and I always did my homework next to a window. My mother said that day, she says, "It seems very windy," she said. "I think you should get away from there." Well, shortly after that, we heard the doorbell ring. Daddy was coming home. Daddy came into the door. The tree, huge tree, fell through our window. We were on the top floor. And I had just gotten away, smashed everything. All the glass went through the dining room table, everything was scarred. How lucky we both were.
That's called guardian angel. That's no luck, and that's providence. We heard the same story earlier, and believe it or not, I've heard a dozen stories just like that for this hurricane.
But, you know, we didn't have any inkling of this. It was just a storm. So then after that, we all moved down to the first floor. Everybody got out from the right down to the first floor.
Which was smart. Unless you're along the coast, you go up to the higher floor.
Glass lights. We were all up, everybody, from the three floors down to the first floor. We stayed up all night praying.
Does anybody else have an account that they'd like to relay? Yes.
My brother went up to see my sister in Framingham. She was just becoming a nun. And he got up there, and there's a bunch of nuns standing around saying the rosary. My sister had got locked in the freezer, the meat freezer.
She got locked in the meat freezer.
Oh, yeah. Well, she got out eventually, but I don't know how she got out. I never heard the story. I was in grammar school, and I didn't hear the story of how she got out. But he goes in there, and there's this bunch of nuns saying their rosary for her in the meat freezer.
Wow. Wow. Give me one quick story, please.
Okay.
Where were you at the time?
No, I before the meeting started today, I told Mr. Harrigan, he would be familiar with Musquamicut, Watch Hill, and all those places, because I had left Musquamicut 2 weeks before to go back to college. I'm an old lady. But I have a Canton story I'd like to tell. I didn't know Mr. Harrigan was going to mention Fire Island. I only had one sister, and she was a nun, and she was in Sable on Long Island, stationed there outside Fire Island. Well, we had a wonderful telephone operator in Canton at the time. We talked to our operators then, and she and my mother were very good friends. And my mother said to Marie, I'd love to talk to Marion on Long Island. Well, of course, Long Island was long gone, and as far as that went. Well, Marie Fitzgerald, the telephone operator, spent a good deal of time sitting there trying to get a hold. There was nothing, no telephones left in Canton. So 11 o'clock that night, she drove down to my house with her brother, the policeman, to tell my mother, and went down our long driveway, that my sister was safe with the convent on Long Island. And I think that's interesting.
That's a blessing. Well, thank you very, very much. I appreciate it. It's a pleasure to be here for the Canton Catholic Women's Club. Thank you very much.
We'd like to have this little honorarium of our thank you for...
Well, thank you for the honorarium, and right back at you. This is a donation back to your organization for all the good work that you do in the scholarships. Let's put it right back in there, and thank you very much. You paid me in cookies and coffee. Thank you.
Ladies, one thing I neglected to tell you, that Tina's husband had a medical appointment today, and I didn't call on her, but she asked me to thank the following hostesses: Linda Duvall, Rose Kelleher, Grace Sexton, myself, Eleanor Murphy, she brought something herself, Tina did, Noreen Logan, Jackie Sullivan. And also, I would remind you